integrity in each of the services is also critical to a strong military. General Amos, I have become friends with Major James Wyrick, United States Marine Corps, who I sincerely believe is a man of integrity. Did you fear Major Wyrick at any point?
My name is James Wyrick, and this is Military Justice, my podcast about the system of justice that governs those who protect our nation. Welcome back, listeners. Thanks for joining us again here at Military Justice. Today's going to be a little bit different of a show. In fact, you could call this entire episode a Saved Rounds and Alibis episode. We're taking a break right now from the story of Task Force Violent, but don't worry, we'll be back with the conclusion of that arc. After doing Task Force Violent for a number of episodes now, I've really gotten backed up with the questions from you, the listeners. Overwhelmingly, the questions you have are about the Marine Corps scandal involving nude photographs being posted on Facebook, otherwise known as Marines United. That was the underlying Facebook group that was posting all of these images. So, I'm listening to you. I'm taking a break from Task Force Violent, as I said, and this is going to be a Q&A about Marines United. But I wanted to make sure that I gave you the most balanced perspective I could, so I brought back a friend of the show, Lieutenant Colonel Glenn Hines. We discuss Marines United, we discuss the legislation recently passed by Congress, and we discuss the future of this scandal that we hope will go away soon. Also, Lieutenant Colonel Hines has another aspect of his life. He's also an author. So we discuss his most recent book, Cloudbreak. I'll have that in the show notes, and I will put that on the Twitter feed. Again, that's at PodcastMJ. I know you'll enjoy the book. He's really a talented guy, and I'm even included in one of the stories, so you know it's a good story. Now, to my interview with Lieutenant Colonel Glenn Hines. I'd like to welcome back to the podcast Lieutenant Colonel Glenn Hines, United States Marine Corps Reserve. Glenn, thanks for being here.
James, thanks for having me on again. I appreciate it.
Hey, for the listeners that didn't catch you before, give us a little thumbnail of your career.
Sure. I went to OCS in 1997. I just hit my 20-year all-time combined mark last Monday, May the 22nd, which is a really special day for me. I posted on Facebook and social media about it. It was the day I signed my contract, May 22nd, 1997. I did about 14 and a half years active duty, and then I transitioned into the reserves. So 20 years total combined service as a Marine Corps officer and judge advocate. And, the brief snapshot of my career, again, I've always been a judge advocate. I was a direct accession out of law school and spent the majority of my career as a prosecutor, military judge, and, you know, for a couple of years with you at military commissions, circa 2010 to 2012. That was actually my last active duty job before I transitioned into the reserves.
And you also spent time with the Department of Justice, right?
Correct. So when I was on active duty, as you're aware, and some of your listeners might be aware, there is a job called Special Assistant U.S. Attorney. And depending on where you're stationed, you may have the opportunity while you're on active duty to sort of serve as a collateral assistant U.S. attorney for offenses committed on your installation by civilians. And so I did that for 2 or 3 years when I was at Marine Corps Recruit Depot San Diego. You're not really working for the Department of Justice. You're sort of loosely affiliated with them. You know, you get a neat letter from the U.S. attorney designating you as the military assistant U.S. attorney. So I did that for 3 years in San Diego, but I was a regular assistant U.S. attorney for a little over 2 years in the Western District of Arkansas in 2014.
And in your post-Marine Corps life, or not post, but what are your most recent endeavors?
Well, after I left Department of Justice in August of 2012, I had an opportunity to mobilize and be a legal advisor for the judicial proceedings panel, which I know you followed, you know, one of the various sexual assault panels, civilian panel appointed by Congress to look at the problem of sexual assault in the military and look at ways that we can improve our investigation and prosecution of it, which included looking at, you know, Article 120 and how do we charge those types of offenses. So I did that for about 2 years. I was mobilized for 2 years to Washington, D.C. as a legal advisor for the judicial proceedings panel. And came off that mobilization in October of last year and hung out my shingle for the first time as a criminal defense attorney. And I'm pretty much specialized to federal court with respect to that. I don't do state cases. Being a former AUSA, I'm familiar with the federal system, the federal trial system in the district courts and the appellate system in the circuit courts. And so I limit my practice to federal criminal defense at this time.
Let's skip to the most important part, that where you just wrote that book that included me as a central character.
Yeah, exactly. That is the most important part of the interview today, isn't it?
And your life, yes.
No, I recently published my second book called Cloudbreak, which is basically an anthology of a few nonfiction stories, some fiction short stories, some, I guess what you would call op-ed pieces, some of which had been previously published with Sports Illustrated, The Cauldron, which is an online offshoot of Sports Illustrated, their online platform, and then 14 or 15 other fiction stories. That was my second book. You know, I published my first book, a document, in February of 2016. Cloudbreak was published in April of this year. And of course, the first story, as you mentioned, was about our time down in as prosecutors down in Guantanamo Bay, working on the Nur Uthman Muhammad case, one of the few cases that actually made it through a trial. That was a guilty plea, as you know, and we all know what happened. I write about it in the story. We all know what happened with that case at the end, but that's the first story in the book.
Let's talk about, and this has really been from the listeners, this is almost this entire episode is Save Rounds and Alibis, mostly revolving around the Marine United scandal and the ensuing bill that we now have before Congress, and how that jibes with some of the complaints we heard in the Marine Corps or the Marine United scandal. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I thanks for asking me about it and bringing me on. And I've been following this as much as anyone else. Before I get into it, let me just make my typical disclaimer. You know, none of what anything that I'm going to tell you are my own personal views. They're not to be construed to be the views of the Marine Corps. I am still a lieutenant colonel in the reserves. And so I want to make sure everyone is clear that nothing I say is to be attributed to the Department of Defense, the U.S. Marine Corps, or any other federal government entity. These are my views and my views alone. That said, I think we have two issues here. And I think it's important as we go through this. I enjoy listening to your podcast. I was on one time last fall, and I've listened to all of the episodes, and you're big on talking about the law. You know, this is about military justice and the law in military justice and sometimes in federal and state court. There are two separate issues with respect to this Marine United scandal. And it's not a scandal, as you know, that's limited to the Marine Corps. This is something that I think every branch of military service is probably struggling with right now. So the first issue is the conduct. You know, the conduct of these Marines who are taking these photographs and disseminating them either electronically or physically. We can all agree, and I think most reasonable people agree, this is repugnant conduct. It's repugnant behavior. No one is trying to defend it, except, I guess, you know, the people who are part of this group, you know, who think that this is okay and you can engage in this type of behavior. I think we all agree this is repugnant behavior. But the second issue is, what does the legal system have to say, or the criminal justice system have to say about the behavior? How do you, to use an old prosecutor term, how do we, quote, get at, unquote, this behavior? You know, how do we charge it? How do we bring this behavior that we all agree is morally repugnant into the criminal justice system to where we can charge it, prosecute it, and hold people accountable for it? Because as you know, having been a prosecutor and a defense attorney in your career, there is a distinction between people's conduct and their behavior and whether or not it's criminal or not. And there is a whole lot of behavior in the world that people engage in that is that we can all agree is repugnant, immoral, disgusting, but it's not necessarily criminal. So with that said, you know, I think we all agree on number one, it's repugnant behavior. It shouldn't go on. Decent people shouldn't be doing this kind of thing. The struggle comes when you try to bring it into the criminal justice realm and charge it as a crime. And I've reviewed the recent legislation that's been put up about bringing it under Article 117, perhaps. My opinion on it is that the easiest thing that the Department of Defense could do if they want to stamp out this behavior is to just bring this within the purview of Article 92 and make it an orders violation. Because as you and I both know, the military case law on Article 92 is very deferential with the appellate courts when the military or the Department of Defense, you know, SecDef, or any military commander says something is illegal under Article 92, he or she gets a ton of deference from appellate courts when they review the constitutionality of charging something like that under Article 92. And Article 92 provides for a 2-year maximum sentence. I know from researching this, it appears Navy regulations were recently amended, for example, to bring this sort of conduct within that particular set of regulations to make this conduct illegal. Personally, I think it's a better way for the military to target this behavior. I think when you start trying to make it a separately enumerated defense or offense under Article 117 or anywhere else, you start to tread into constitutional issues.
Father's Day is just around the corner, and as we all know, dads are impossible to shop for. Fortunately, our friends over at Harry's have a special offer that you're going to love, and your dad will also. Get $5 off one of their shaving sets, including a limited edition Father's Day set at harrys.com/military. I can tell you, if you go over to the Twitter feed for Military Justice, that's Podcast MJ, you're going to see the Harry's set that was just recently sent to me. I've been using it. I love it. Harry's razors are great. Their shave creams are great. And this is just what that father in your life needs. So please go to harrys.com/military right now to redeem a special offer for fans of the show. Harry's will give you $5 off one of their shave sets. This is a limited time only, so act now. That's harrys.com/military to get $5 off and help support the show. Thanks, listeners. What we're talking about, the specific bill, I don't know that it's numbered yet, but it was introduced into Congress by Republican Congresswoman McSally. It is the Protecting the Rights of Individuals Against Technological Exploitation, or the Private Act. And that just recently, just a few days ago, passed the House, and I think unanimously passed the House. And that bill, from my reading, is limited really to revenge porn. That, you know, a prohibition, any person subject to this chapter who knowingly and wrongfully broadcasts or distributes an intimate visual image of a private area of a person that they have a reasonable expectation of privacy in will be guilty of this violation. And then if we look at the definitions, intimate visual images are any that were taken by means that depict the private areas of a person. Then you go to private areas. The term private area means the naked or underwear clad genitalia, anus, buttocks, or female areola or nipple. Okay, wow, I got through that. This is definitely a PG-13 and above podcast. But I want to look at that and compare that to one of the lead young female Marines who was very brave in bringing all of this to light. And she mentions, quote, "I am one of the women Marines whose photos were posted on the internet, on Marines United, and on other sites without my knowledge or consent. Although my photos showed me fully clothed and appropriately dressed, comments were posted by some individuals who viewed my photos, and comments were made regarding sexual violence." So as I see this, there's a few different areas to discuss. And some of this, rightfully so, this is under investigation by NCIS. So we don't know the contours of what exactly is going on in those criminal investigations. But it seems that we have revenge pornography, and that would be covered by this new bill. That means something that was just intended to be shared with some significant other that is then broadcast to the world. And I think we can all agree that that's pretty reprehensible and should be covered in a criminal statute. But then we have other things like that young Marine who had photos from her Twitter account taken and reposted, and then comments were made. So you have, I don't know that people have a reasonable expectation of privacy in their Twitter feed, you know, photographs that they put up there. And then we go on to talk about threats. You know, who were those threats communicated to? So I've asked you an extremely long question, but let's maybe if we could step through that one at a time. What are your thoughts on the revenge pornography bill?
Yeah, so it is a convoluted, and the further down the line you get on the different factual scenarios, and as you know, and any of your listeners know who are legal people or law students or lawyers, the result in any given case is fact dependent. Okay, and how the law relates to that is extremely fact dependent. So the first point, these revenge porn statutes, in researching for the interview, I think the consensus is these revenge porn statutes, again, we can all agree that the reason for these statutes is it's a good reason. We all agree. We don't want this sort of conduct to go on. But I think the jury, in terms of the appellate courts, are still out on the constitutionality of the various revenge porn statutes that are actually out there right now on the state level and at any level. And I do not believe, I would welcome any listener to educate us, but I don't think the Supreme Court has spoken yet on these revenge porn statutes with respect to whether they're constitutional, you know, under the First Amendment. So again, like I said, two issues. We all agree that people should not be taking these pictures or videos and putting them out there. The question becomes, what does a victim do? Is a victim limited to suing that individual for an invasion of privacy, as we've seen with a lot of celebrities, if you will, you know, who've had these sex tapes fall into someone's hands and then someone puts it out there? Is it a lawsuit or is it a crime? So that question is still open. The Supreme Court hasn't really spoken on, okay, revenge porn. What are the specific facts? Are these intimate photos or videos that someone has a reasonable expectation of privacy in and that were either stolen or taken and put out there against a person's consent? One thing I want to interpose while we're discussing this is Article 120C of the UCMJ criminalizes some of this conduct already under what we call the voyeurism statute. It punishes the indecent visual recording, the indecent viewing, or the indecent broadcasting of these types of photographs or videos. And if you look at the text of Article 120C and you overlay this new bill under Article 117, it sort of looks like whoever drafted this bill, 95% of the language in it follows Article 120C. And what Article 120C talks about is the non-consensual photographing, for lack of a better term, of one of these situations. And right. So the idea is someone has taken a surreptitious video and the victim doesn't even, or the victims, let's say it's a man and a woman, a man and a man, a woman and a woman. Someone has taken a surreptitious photograph or video of these people, and it might be even be one of the people who's taking part, in this sexual act, surreptitiously filming it without his or her partner's consent. That is punishable under Article 120C right now. And if you view that, it's a maximum punishment of dishonorable discharge in 1 year. If you record it, it's 5 years. And if you broadcast it, it's 7 years. So 120C has some teeth in it already. What we're talking about with Marines United is one or two steps removed from that. As I look at this scandal or this problem, what we're talking about is not a situation where the person was photographed without their consent. It's a situation in most of these cases where the putative victim consented, in the photograph or the video. So the fact pattern is, as you've read and as I've read, some of these are selfies that have been put on people's, their own Instagram account, and that they've taken with their own knowledge and maybe exchanged with their partner or someone else. But then what happens is that photograph or recording that was consensually made in the inception somehow falls into the hands of someone else that the putative victim doesn't want it, to be in their hands. And so the other person takes it either off of Instagram or the internet, and then they start to exchange it with other people, or put it on a website like Marine United, or republish it.
Yes, and that's exactly what happened with my guest Heather, the last podcast about Marines United. She was a young Marine, and she had her Outlook or her email account was just hacked, and that's how her intimate photos got out onto the internet.
Right, and so I think in a situation like that, where the putative victim, and I keep saying putative because I think we have to be very careful the way that we approach this legally. In my mind, there's a distinction and a difference between someone who is engaging in some sort of intimate sexual behavior consensually with another adult and is being photographed or taped, and he or she doesn't even know that. That's a crime under Article 120C.
Right. And I think the Marine Corps, the military in general, has done a reasonably good job of protecting our service members from that. I know that when I was at appellate government, we had, it was a Marine Corps court reporter who was setting up a camera in the women's head. And right. We definitely took that seriously. I think he received 5 years, but that's not something that we've ignored. Please keep going.
I think everyone agrees that if you look at the case law in the civilian world, military, it's very similar. The courts have upheld these statutes where someone has been photographed or recorded without their consent, without their knowledge, as being a crime. Okay, so that's not what we're talking about right now. What we're talking about is someone is either photographing themselves or, they and their paramour are recording it or photographing it, and they know that they're being photographed, And then they do whatever they do with the video. They either upload it onto Instagram or somewhere else. And here's the question. I think the legal question that's going to be, as these statutes go forward with the appellate courts, what the courts are going to ask, because this new bill, Article 117, speaks in terms of reasonable expectation of privacy. And that's what Article 120C talks about. The question is going to be, you know, if I have an Instagram account and I upload a video like this onto my Instagram account, do I still have a reasonable expectation of privacy that someone's not going to come into my Instagram account and get their hands on that? Or if I upload it anywhere else? I think the Supreme Court and the military courts have followed suit. They are very strict when they interpret that phrase. You and I both know that, for instance, you know, if you throw out a piece of something into the garbage, the police can drive over to your house without a search warrant and they can go through your garbage. And if they find a legitimate item of seizure, that they can seize all of that. And if it incriminates you, well, the courts will say, when you put it in the garbage and you set it out on the side of the road for the garbage truck to come pick up, you have abandoned any expectation of privacy, let alone a reasonable one in the contents of that garbage. Now, I'm not trying to make a direct analogy between something you upload on into your Instagram account, but I'm just saying these are the questions the courts are going to have to work through, because I think the courts are very strict that if you put something either physically or electronically in a place where a reasonable person would say you're not really attempting to keep that private, the courts are not going to recognize that you have a reasonable expectation of privacy in that. So,
no, absolutely, because you could take your Twitter or your Instagram and make that a private account, or just your media settings would allow you to make that a private account, or are you sharing them more generally? And so, like you're saying, if it's generally shared out there, it's just part of your Twitter or Instagram feed, it's hard to imagine the courts finding that you would have a reasonable expectation of privacy in those photographs.
Right. And I think that's where the litigation is going to be. I think the legislation that's pending is well drafted and it's admirable to target this conduct. Again, I think the courts would be, or I think the military would be well served to simply bring this within the ambit of, you know, various Article 92 orders and regulations. The courts are much more deferential, as you know, to orders, military orders and regulations, because we're treated differently in the military. We have a lowered expectation of privacy. You know, the DOD and commanders can criminalize certain things under Article 92 that legislatures would not be able to criminalize in states or in the federal government. And I just simply think that if they were to stand on Article 92 alone, because all they have to articulate is a legitimate military purpose, and that's to preserve good order and discipline. The idea being, we don't want our Marines or airmen or sailors or soldiers or Coast Guardsmen engaging in this kind of behavior because it's extremely prejudicial to good order and discipline. It can create a cancer in a unit, especially when one of the victims is a female or a male within the same unit. And so I think I beat that dead horse enough. And I think if they purport to put this into Article 117 or somewhere else, they get on the slippery slope to challenges at trial before military judges. I foresee motions to dismiss on constitutional grounds in a fact scenario where an image or a recording has been voluntarily taken by a putative victim and then published on Instagram or YouTube or somewhere else. And the victim saying, well, you know, I wanted my Instagram people to be able to see this, but I didn't want the accused to be able to see this or distribute it. I think we're going to see some motions to dismiss on constitutional grounds. The courts may uphold if this legislation passes, and that's the way we start to prosecute this type of behavior. The courts may uphold it. I just feel like there are going to be defense attorneys in the military lining up to file motions to dismiss based on First Amendment grounds.
I think this is also a good time to make sure that we're clear. I think some of the listeners may not have fully got this from my last podcast on this. This is no blaming of the victim. You know, I've seen a lot of this where that putative victim, like, well, if you didn't want nude photos, you shouldn't have made them in the first place. Neither of us, I can for sure say myself, I am not doing any victim blaming here. I think we're just trying to discuss what boundaries there are in the criminal setting. And there may be many times where we could say that this person needs to be administratively separated from the Marine Corps to say, you know, this isn't the type of conduct that we expect of our Marines. But that might not rise to the level of criminal misconduct because, as we've discussed and you've pointed out brilliantly about the First Amendment concerns here, I want to make sure that we get across that there's no victim blaming going on here. We just want to make sure that there's the correct statutes and the statutes are narrowly tailored to define criminal and non-criminal acts.
Right. I completely agree with you. And I want the listeners to understand I'm not defending any of this conduct. We're both trained to look at all of these issues as lawyers. And to be a good lawyer, you have to be objective. You can't let passion or emotion cloud your analysis. And I think we would both agree that if the military is going to criminalize any type of behavior, you want to draft your statute such that it's going to withstand appellate court scrutiny, and you don't have to come back in 3 or 4 or 5 years and redraft it. And then you've convicted a bunch of people on a statute that appellate courts now say is infirm, and you have to throw all of those convictions out and start all over again. I think we're on the same page. And as a side note, I agree. I believe the Marine Corps and I think the other branches have added to their various administrative separation regulations, they've added this conduct to that. But you and I both know that's not a criminal conviction. It's simply a means to separate someone administratively. The worst case scenario under that process is an other than honorable discharge. And I want to make something clear, too. I think there's a big difference between someone who's trolling through the internet and they stumble upon some sort of photograph or video, and then someone going above and beyond that and contacting the person in the video and harassing them or sexually harassing them or making threatening comments to them. That's a completely distinct and separate situation. And legally, it's a separate situation. You might be able to prosecute the person who's making threats, and you're not even referring to the fact that they have accessed a photograph or a video that they shouldn't, have in their possession. They're simply engaging now in completely separate conduct, which is threatening or stalking type of conduct. And so we have various statutes out there with respect to prosecuting threats or stalking or cyber stalking. So, yeah, I agree with you. I want to make it clear. I'm not defending this conduct. I'm just looking at it as an old prosecutor or a judge. How can we best, if this is something that everyone decides on the same page, this is a particular evil that we want to criminalize, how do we do that such that it withstands appellate court scrutiny so that we can all, then turn around to our young Marines, male and female, because we both know that men can be victims of this as well. Our young Marines, sailors, airmen, soldiers, and Coast Guardsmen, and then train them. Okay, and go ahead and educate them and say, this is the level of conduct that's expected of you. And if you do these things here, 1, 2, 3, A, B, C, and D, you're going to be in trouble. And this is one of them. You want to be able to have a tool to where in entry-level training, you can educate your new people on standards of conduct and the things that are crimes. And these are the 40,000-foot, issues that you and I are thinking about, not just this is reprehensible, these people should be punished. Well, yeah, I think we all agree on that. How do we do it? How do we do it successfully?
Yeah, and you mentioned, male victims. I can tell you at least two times for sure in my Marine Corps career, one time as an investigating officer and the other time on the appellate level, that we had back in the don't ask, don't tell days, I know that we had what would definitely be revenge porn that was sent to the command of, in the case at MCRD, it was a male Marine who had a boyfriend off base. They broke up. The old boyfriend sent really explicit videos of the two of them engaging in various sexual acts. And not only did we not view that as revenge porn, we actually use that as a basis to separate that Marine from the Marine Corps. So I think that it's important to see that this, now that was, in my estimation, that was wrong to do back then, but it wasn't my call. But this isn't just a single sex issue, that this cuts in all different ways.
Right. We're in a world now where when you and I first came in, don't ask, don't tell, which was the policy that the Clinton administration instituted in the early 90s, that has gone away. And we do not discriminate now with respect to sexual orientation. Anyone can serve in the military regardless of their sexual orientation. And so there have been a lot of good things about getting rid of that old policy. But one of them is we've been able to successfully prosecute more male-on-male sexual assault because now we have a situation where there's not this stigma anymore of, a male is sexually assaulted by another male. And the way that used to be defended was you attacked the guy because, the argument was he was a gay man and didn't he consent? You consented to this, right? Would be the defense attack. And now we're changing that old sort of stereotype. And we're starting to see a lot more male-on-male sexual assault cases not only reported but prosecuted, female-on-female sexual assault cases prosecuted. So this is not I know when we look at the various data, it does still tend to be male offenders offending either against a female or a male victim. And it's much more rare for a female to be the offender, but it's not out of the realm of possibility. And we do see, female sexual assaults on female victims, and we see females engaging in this kind of repugnant behavior that we're talking about right now. So
I agree with all of that. Now I want to move on to, for the listener, both the bill that just passed Congress and this new social media policy, I'll have those in the show notes for your reference. But now we have the Marine Corps Social Media Personal Reference Guide for Marines. And guidance to Bravo. A Marine who violates federal law, regulations, or policies through inappropriate personal online activity is subject to disciplinary action under the UCMJ. And then we go down to Delta. Quote, Marines should avoid offensive and inappropriate behavior that could bring discredit upon themselves and the Marine Corps. This behavior includes posting any defamatory, libelous, obscene, abusive, threatening, racially or ethnically hateful or otherwise offensive or illegal information or material, unquote. Here's the problem I think that I know for myself as a lawyer look at, especially that otherwise offensive language. So, and I think we had this in Marines United. Again, it's under investigation by NCIS. It's going to be very fact dependent. But you hear people saying that threats were made to them. But I'm not sure that the threats, or it hasn't been made clear from the report, that the threats were made directly to them. And that could be the case in some of these issues. But it seems that sometimes that were just, there's the photograph, and then there were a number of lewd comments below the photograph. And criminalizing that, I think that's not a black and white issue by any means.
No, I mean, there are various ways to punish threats, communicating a threat under the UCMJ already. There are ways to publish threats that are communicated electronically and also over the phone under the U.S. Code, Title 18. And as you and I both know, in military courts, you can assimilate or bring in the federal statute under Title 18 if it's not directly covered under the UCMJ. That's rarely done. But I charged cases like that. I prosecuted threat cases as an assistant U.S. attorney that were either made via email or phone threats. Those are easily covered, and it's a very pliable statute, and the UCMJ article is very pliable. But I think you hit the rub of the question. You know, is this a real threat? If it is a threat, what are they threatening to do? Did the recipient perceive it as a threat? So,
and was it communicated to the recipient?
Exactly. I mean, is it just some offensive comment about a photograph or a video, or is it a threat? You know, directed at the person in the video. So, again, it sort of brings me back around to, if you criminalize these types of behaviors under Article 92, the government is on its strongest footing. You know, when it attempts to charge these things, and you indicated that a lot of these regulations have very generally worded and pliable language that's often open to interpretation. But when it's charged under our Article 92, the government gets a lot more deference, you know, in the law, and they get more deference in the jury instructions that the military judge gives to the panel members. So that's why I think the Marine Corps and the Navy were smart, or I guess the Navy and the Marine Corps, if you want to go in the right order, to amend the Navy regulations, which apply to both, you know, sailors and Marines, to include very broadly speaking, this type of conduct. And as I said, all you have to do when you're articulating that order is to articulate a legitimate military purpose, and that is to preserve good order and discipline. And when those orders are drafted and they're drafted correctly, they almost always withstand scrutiny by a military judge or an appellate court. I think it's when you get off into Article 117 or Article 134 or these other places where you start to get on thin ice, and when you try to generally criminalize, again, I'm not talking about administrative separation or things that we can all recognize are repugnant behavior. I'm talking about making it a crime now to where you're both going to tell someone you have a criminal record and we're going to take your freedom away. That's when appellate courts start to worry about, okay, are we treading too far into, you know, First Amendment protection? And one thing I want to reiterate real quickly is that the only reason I keep talking about the First Amendment, it's not because I think anyone should have a right to engage in this kind of conduct. I'm just saying that this is typically where the government falls through a trap door when they attempt to criminalize this kind of conduct or anything that could be construed as speech, or, you know, someone making a statement on the internet or distributing materials that we might otherwise think are distasteful, aka pornography, which if you look at the Supreme Court jurisprudence on pornography, it's very gray. You know, some of it is they criminalize obscene material, but on the other hand, pornography, the Supreme Court has basically said, well, people have a right to create this stuff. They have a right to watch it. They have a right to possess it. And you and I both know that pornography is widely recognized by the people who have studied it. It's an
Don't
insidious.
Don't speak for me, Glenn. I do not engage in any of that.
Well, no, I don't.
You know it when you see it, right?
Yeah, I don't think you have to, you know, dime yourself out one way or the other with respect to pornography. You just look at the law on it, and the law says one thing, and the researchers say something different, which is that it has an insidious effect on basically young men in this country who can become easily addicted to it, and then it creates all sorts of behavioral issues with respect to, you know, their identity when they transition from being a teenager to an adult. It infects the way that they relate to women. They start to think, well, this is the way sex is supposed to be. I personally, again, you know, I think it has a lot to do with pornography. And I know a lot of people will say, well, you sound like an old-fashioned individual. I'm just saying the studies are out there. Read the studies. They're objective. I know from being a prosecutor for a long time that serial killers – you know, the Ted Bundys of the world and some of the people who transition into sexual assault and sexual murder. And I hate, you know, I don't want to offend your listeners too much. They tell a similar story. It all started off by viewing pornography. Right. Ted Bundy said it started off by viewing pornography, and then that wasn't enough. And so then he had to take it to the next level. And eventually what happens is they decide they want to act out what's being portrayed in the video. And again, if you work on any of those cases, it's some of the most, you know, pernicious evil in the world. I went down that road simply to say the Supreme Court has said that you have a constitutional right under the First Amendment to create pornography as long as it involves adults, now consenting adults, create it, to possess it, and to view it. And you and I, again, we all can say, well, this is a behavior that we find repugnant. But the Supreme Court itself has said there's a First Amendment right to do all of those things with respect to it. So the only reason I went down that little side road was to bring it back to our discussion, which is, if the Supreme Court says that that's okay, how different, you know, what are the factual situations that make Marines United and, you know, people possessing and distributing what essentially is pornography that was consensually made in the inception, how is that different than, you know, other types of pornography? That's a question. I just throw it out to say that's a question that Congress is going to have to get into when they decide to criminalize this. And it's a question trial courts and appellate courts are going to have to grapple with as we go forward on this issue.
Yeah, and I agree with that. And I would also say this is a little bit vague language that the Marine Corps uses in their order to say that anything that is abusive or otherwise offensive is then criminalized. I know there's a Facebook group that you and I both belong to, a private group of Marine lawyers. And I posted on there, it was a very popular meme. I think it's actually a colleague of ours, it's a Marine judge advocate, who's in the foreground of this photograph. And in the background, you can see an army soldier who looks to be a little bit out of height and weight standards. And, you know, it went around as a meme, you know, the Marine Corps making fun of the Army. And does that now fall under, is that abusive? Is that an offensive communication? And also you get into a lot of, especially online, a lot of online flame wars where you have, you know, young Marines, you know, going back and forth with people and calling them names and saying, you know, yeah, I think you have a mental defect. I think, you know, you really need to get a psychological evaluation. And is that something that we should be criminalizing, or is that something more akin to just people's communication? And that's where I have difficulty with this order. Is it going a really broad scope of conduct that would otherwise be, again, maybe distasteful, but that doesn't deprive of it of its constitutional protection?
Well, it's a tough question to answer. I guess I would default back to the typical Marine Corps fix on a lot of issues is, you know, you've got the level of conduct or the red line that you're not supposed to cross. And what does every staff NCO or gunny do? They tell the Marines, don't even get within, you know, 100 feet of the red line. You know, this is tolerated, but you're not going to get within 100 feet of it.
And looking out for their Marines, you know, well-being, that really is a good thing that those staff NCOs are doing.
Right. And so I kind of look at this as, again, it's a distinction between two things. I think what we should be doing is hammering home and training that this is just not, it's like the commandant said in his video. Okay, putting aside whether anything's criminal or not, do you really want to be a Marine? Right, if you really want to be a Marine, is this the way you should be treating your fellow Marines? Or if the victim is not a Marine, is this really the way that you should be treating a civilian man or a woman? Okay, because you're not living up to the standard. Okay, I think it's one of those things we all agree upon. And so I don't know that it necessarily has to be a crime in order for us to start educating our Marines and everyone else that, listen, this is just not something you should be doing. Okay, you're not engaging in appropriate behavior if you're doing this. The thing that I might point out is, however, I bet if someone went, and I'm just not as educated on the numbers as everyone else, but again, going back to the whole pornography situation and epidemic, we know that the vast majority of purveyors of that type of product are young men, you know, between the ages of, pick your teenage, you know, years, and it probably gets earlier and earlier as we go forward in society. I would say 18 to 25, 18 to 30 are probably your biggest purveyors of this. And hopefully, you know, once people turn 30, they begin to sort of, you know, move on to something else. But I think that's a point that people do not spend enough time focusing on. And again, you can't prohibit, you know, people from looking at stuff that the Supreme Court has said they have a constitutional right to consume. But you can try to educate them that, look, this is just not going to lead to good results. If you're trolling around on the internet in your free time and you come into possession of photographs or videos of people engaging in sexually explicit conduct, and you're just going to become a part of a group and you're going to exchange all of this, it's just doesn't appear to me to be something that's very socially uplifting or something that feeds the character of the individuals who are taking part in it.
I think what Glenn and I are trying to say is speed up your life, become an old man, and get in get into golf or barbecuing, and then that you'll be helped out.
Or writing books, you know, or something like that. You won't get into as much trouble.
And I totally agree with you. I think the Commandant absolutely hit it out of the park with his video. It was tremendous, and I encourage everyone to go look at that. I'll put that in the show notes. But we got to stop with Marines United. I probably will have you back on the podcast to discuss it again, because I want to make sure we have time to, in the next 10 minutes or so, talk about your writing career. I've loved both of your books. Great storytelling. And how did you go from someone interested in writing to getting a published book?
I did it a non-traditional way. So a little bit of background. I always wanted to, sort of had a dream to write and publish a book or books or stories. You know, my mother's a retired English teacher, taught English for 27 years, and sort of she was the one who gave me my love of reading and love of books and that sort of thing. I didn't become a very serious writer, however, until, like you, I did my second tour as an appellate government counsel at the Navy Yard, where I was sort of an appellate prosecutor. And yeah, legal writing is completely different from nonfiction or fiction writing, but it's not that different. And I learned a lot about the mechanics of writing.
Well, actually, the better your legal writing, the closer it is to storytelling, because you're not just regurgitating a bunch of citations. You are leading your audience to a conclusion.
Exactly. And I came into contact while I was there with a man named Brian Garner, who for years was the editor-in-chief
he's great.
Black Law Dictionary. But he sort of taught me and taught my colleagues. He turned a lot of stuff that we learned in grammar school and high school and college on its ear with respect to writing and writing. And you kind of already answered the question. He said, look, writing your appellate brief is not all that different from writing a compelling story. You know, you want to persuade and you want people to believe you. And part of that was using, you know, a Socratic a syllogism, you know, to make your arguments. And so in any event, I became over those 3 years a much more efficient writer, learned to write with an aggressive voice rather than a passive voice. I won't bore your readers too much with going too deep on that. But in any event, I felt like I was a much better writer after that. And when I went back to be a trial prosecutor, my motions practice was much better. When I became a judge, my orders, I think, were much better written. And so I just, you know, to answer your question, I never really had the time to do any creative writing on my own during my active duty career. I was too busy. I was way too busy as an assistant U.S. attorney, and I didn't really have enough time to do it until I went on that mobilization that I was telling you about that started in September 2014. And it's not that I didn't have enough work to do. It's just I was in a billet with the judicial proceedings panel that went from, you know, 8 a.m. till 5 p.m. They shut down.
Well, and anyone who's ever been in the military knows that being a geo bachelor or a geographic bachelor frees up a lot of your time. Yeah. There's no more honey-do lists or anything along those lines, so you have to find a way to fill that void.
Yeah. So I had a lot of time on my hands after work because, as you mentioned, I was a geo bachelor living by myself in D.C. And so I had an opportunity with a few outlets. Task and Purpose was one of them. It gave me an opportunity to write a couple of, I guess, what I'll call op-ed pieces on military commissions and some other issues. And after the reception for those pieces, I started to kind of branch out a little more. And then I wrote an article that was picked up by Sports Illustrated at the start of football season in 2015 about the concussion crisis. And after that, I felt like, well, this isn't rocket science. Apparently, people think that I can write a coherent sentence and they like what I have to say. And so I began to fill up my time by just writing stories, nonfiction, fiction, op-ed pieces, whenever the idea popped into my head. And at the time, it was pretty much 24/7. I might get a new idea, you know, for something else. And I decided in late 2015 that I had accumulated enough of these stories that it was actually my wife who suggested, you know, you don't need to write an 80,000 word novel. Just combine all of your stories into an anthology and see if you can get someone to publish that. And when I did the math, she was right. It came out to 70 or 75,000 words, which is what, if you study writing, most people say a novel is something over 40,000 words. And so I had well over that. So as I said, I went the non-traditional route, and both of my books have been published independently with Amazon. Amazon has their own internal publishing house called CreateSpace.
And so do you just contact them and say that this and send them a manuscript? How does that happen?
Well, you pretty much can do it however you want. And Amazon has a great group of editors and in-house people who, you know, for a price, again, which, you know, everyone can say, ha ha ha, will give you whatever help you need. My first book, I pretty much did without any help from Amazon. I edited, I proofread, I did everything by myself. And you upload the manuscript and it's essentially turned into a book by Amazon's CreateSpace in either a print version or Kindle. And most people probably are familiar with electronic reading now, either on their Kindle device or if you have an iPad or any other sort of notebook, you can order books electronically through Kindle, you know, and you don't have to purchase the print version. But in any event, CreateSpace with Amazon will do that, and they will publish your book either in print copy and or in electronic copy. So that's what I did with my first book, Document, which came out in February 2016. That was a neat learning process because I learned that I probably needed help editing and with how the book looked.
Yeah, now you could definitely see progress between Document and then Cloudbreak.
Yeah, I'll take that as a compliment.
Yeah, no, it definitely is a criticism
of the first book. But
me, of course, that's why it's a criticism.
Well, and I would suggest to anyone who's out there and they are thinking about going this route, with my second book, Cloudbreak, I enlisted the help of Amazon and I let them do the editing. I let them do the grammar checking. I let them do the formatting, and I paid them a little bit of money, but it's nominal in the big scheme of things, and it's worth its weight in gold because it just takes so much stress off of you trying to do your own proofreading. Anyone who's edited or proofread a document, especially their own work, after you've read through it 10 times, it becomes torturous.
You just skip over things because you're like, oh, I know what this is. No, absolutely, you have to have that second set of eyes.
Right. And so I did that with CloudBreak, and I think the result was much better. As far as, I think the print version reads a lot better. It's easier on the eye, so to speak. The marketing that they've done with CloudBreak is a little bit better. And so, you know, in the end, what I would suggest is this. What I've found out through publishing two books independently is book publishing is still a very old situation where you have to have an agent. And then your agent, you know, if you can actually find one who knows what they're doing, your agent is the one who will contact the traditional publishing houses for you and attempt to get you a publishing contract. That's a very long, arduous, and tedious process. And there are no guarantees that any of the publishing houses are ever going to call your agent back or, you know, accept your manuscript. And it can take years. And so I just decided I had these two sets of material that were relevant. I felt they were relevant for today's world and to people like you.
Absolutely. I've really enjoyed CloudBreak. I can't recommend it enough to the listeners. If you just want, most of the listeners here are interested in the military. You do a great job of even a story that I was involved in. And I got to see it through your eyes. And you do a great job of painting that picture. Because the Knorr trial, I was there the whole time, but it's like I got to rediscover the story through you.
Yeah, it's been very rewarding. Some of the feedback I've gotten, you know, I haven't been at commissions for 5 years, and I've received several just emails and texts from people or LinkedIn messages from people who were there when we were there who, through word of mouth, have found out about the book and have read the story. And they may not have worked on the Knorr case with us, but they certainly were in the trenches with us during those years. And they've all been very complimentary and said that they've enjoyed just the realness of the story. And that's the way I try to write. I'm not big on flowery language and prose. I like to write very direct sentences, you know, and just get to the point. And the Gitmo story in CloudBreak sort of started as a, hey, I'm going to write this story down so that me and the Weyrich and Michael Clayton and Dan Cowig and the people that worked on the case with us might have some sort of record out there to reflect what we had done. In the commission cases that have gotten that far, I think we can still count them on two hands, maybe.
Right.
7 or 8 cases, and we were part of one of them. And I swore out the charges on another one. And it was a great experience, a great learning experience, and we worked with some great people. And as I say in my prologue, CloudBreak was a labor of love because I wrote it over about a year period when I was mobilized as a GO bachelor, as you say, and writing sort of filled up that time between, you know, 17 or 1800 and whenever I went to bed and on the weekends, when I just needed something to do. And so I'm appreciative of everyone's feedback on it. And I would.
And just you've seen it now in bookstores, right?
Yeah. It's amazing. So Amazon.
That's got to be hugely rewarding.
Well, we're in a very interesting time now with respect to book publishing. As everyone probably is aware, Amazon is such a huge, monstrous conglomerate now. They have, you know, the critics say they've put the mom and pop bookstores out of business. They've really cut into Barnes and Noble, you know, and the big book houses. I mean, what would you do if you want a book? Would you get in your car and drive, you know, and look around Barnes and Noble, or would you just pull up Amazon and order it? I mean, it's a no-brainer. And so the neat thing is Barnes and Noble realizes what's going on, and they sort of have partnered with Amazon. And both of my books are not only available on Amazon, they're available on BarnesandNoble.com and also at Books A Million, which is another one of the last remaining, I guess I would say, big book houses, you know, where you can actually drive into
a brick and mortar.
Right, where you can actually go into, you know, the store and search and purchase the book. And I think that's kind of a gentleman's agreement they have with one another. And so with respect to Barnes & Noble, you can submit your book to their headquarters and just request that it be put in all of their stores. But you can also contact their local managers, and their local managers have the discretion to put local authors, you know, or regional authors, those sorts of people to put their books in their store. And it's not necessarily in every Barnes & Noble store, but and I've done that. If you're an independent author, you have to get creative with the marketing. And so I've gone out and done interviews with some websites like SeriousReading.com and Goodreads and that sort of thing to sort of try to market my work. But no, Barnes & Noble has been very good. You know, the local Barnes & Noble here and in, I was in Minneapolis last week, had it in their store. And so it's kind of neat to go in and see, you know, if you're not John Grisham or one of these people, you know, to go in and see, okay, is it in here? Is it in this one?
That's cool.
You know, so yeah, when I was there last week, I had to take a picture of it to prove it to my wife that it was actually in hard copy in the store. So it was kind of cool.
Hey, two final issues for you. One, will you help listeners or answer their questions about getting published if they're interested in it?
Of course. I was going to mention that, and you, your question reminded me. I will be happy, free of charge, to answer any questions on independent publishing, you know, create space with Amazon.com, what my experience has been like. It's been a lot of fun. And I would highly recommend doing independent publishing the first maybe one or two times around before you know, I look at it as it's been a way for me to get my name out there. And so now I feel like if I actually do a manuscript, you know, a full-length manuscript, I can go to an agent and say, well, look, I have these two other books. You need to look at these two books and what people are saying about them. I think that just puts you on more firm ground, you know, when you're trying to get that big book deal. But no, I'm on Twitter. I am on LinkedIn. I have a Facebook writers page. It's Glenn, G-L-E-N, Hines, H-I-N-E-S. Email is glenn.hines@outlook.com. If someone wants to send me a direct email, I'm happy to answer any and all questions with respect to writing, publishing, or anything else.
And the other item I was going to ask you for is your Twitter handle. The listeners are really great about Twitter. And as soon as this show goes up, I will tweet out that information along with a direct link to your latest book. Where can they find you on Twitter?
Twitter, it's Glenn_R, R as in Romeo, _Hines, H-I-N-E-S.
I'll put that in the show notes also. Glenn, thank you for joining us again. Military Justice is a production of Long Arc Digital Media. There are numerous people that need to be thanked for making Military Justice possible. First of all, audio. Those are the people that clean up all the mistakes I made. Hannah McCarthy, she takes care of that. Methil Talhan, she takes care of everything. She keeps the show moving along and keeps all of us on schedule. Executive producer is Dennis Robinson. You know him from Undisclosed and The Wearing of Underwear. And as always, Uber producer Dreadnought has my six.